One of the ways to generational wealth is through real estate investing, but undoubtedly, it has to be smart and methodical. Investopedia defines the term generational wealth as assets passed by one generation of family to another. Title 8 of the Civil Rights Act of 1968, the Fair Housing Act, as amended, prohibits discrimination in the sale, rental, and financing of dwellings and in other housing-related transactions because of race, color, religion, sex, etc. And the 14th Amendment, prohibiting housing discrimination on the basis of handicap, was a valid exercise of Congress's 14th Amendment power. Section 5 of the 14th Amendment empowers Congress to enact appropriate legislation to enforce the Equal Protection Clause. Following a national housing conference in 1973, a group of Chicago community organizations led by the Northwest Community Organization formed National People's Action to broaden the fight against disinvestment and mortgage redlining in neighborhoods all over the country. With all that being said, Baltimore is a great place to invest. Yes, I said it. Sure, we have some issues that need to be addressed, but many can begin to be solved through investment and certainly generational wealth. Welcome to 2B More. I'm your host, TJ Smith, and today I have the privilege to speak with a couple who is doing their best to educate the masses on their investment options right here in Baltimore. Not only is it an opportunity to create another stream of income, but it is an opportunity to help our city that can use more investment. Just last week, they graced the folds of Essence Magazine's feature story, The Family Business. These partners are building generational wealth through entrepreneurship. And they join us now and welcome the Charm City Buyers, Ms. Kiara Gray and Mr. Khalil Yupta. Thank you both for joining me. How are you today?
Hey, doing great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's a beautiful day in Baltimore here.
Yes, yes. I mean, look, we know we have a ton of issues that go on in our city every day, but what city doesn't? And you have to struggle through something to get somewhere. And we're going through some things, but that means opportunity. Before we get into the nuts and bolts, I want to know how you both got started in this business.
Yeah, so I closed, born and raised in Baltimore, has family that's always been of and from Baltimore. Myself, I'm from actually outside of Philadelphia, close to Lincoln University. And so I was introduced to real estate, just kind of watching and seeing things happen. Don't have family or anything in real estate, but understood the concept of land ownership through learning about the history of my family. And so in really the early 1800s, the 1820s, my family started their own town called Hinsonville. That's now the land that Lincoln University sits on. And so as a child hearing that story, I didn't know or understand what that was going to mean, what seeds were being planted at the time, but understanding the power of home of ownership, power of community, power of, you know, being able to start and create your own things, and really loving that transition, you know, from seeing things just grow and flourish through putting in some love and sweat equity and some elbow grease and things. So I've always been interested in real estate, and it's always been something that I wanted to get into when we left college. And Khalil's just always been entrepreneurial.
Wow. So Khalil, you got lucky. You got lucky. How did you, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, what's funny. They say, you know, sometimes you marry down, sometimes you marry equal, sometimes you marry up. And then there's like that sometimes you marry exponentially higher, right?
Right.
No, I yeah. So Kiara and I met in college, and it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. And we were both focused, type A, driven, ready to make some real positive change in different areas. And real estate was the venue that we chose to make that change. So I've been interested since kind of graduating college and looking at different structures and different ways to grow capital and make impact. For me, entrepreneurship is at the core of everything I do and always have done since I was, you know, a little kid. So when I was looking at how can I make a positive impact, how can I impact the community, How can I create a legacy, to something to pass on to the next? And how can I build wealth and live a lifestyle of my dreams? Real estate checked all of those boxes. And when Kiara was interested and talked to me about the things that her background in it and her interest in it also, I was like, hey, let's move forward. So we were about 22 or 23 years old when we bought our first property. And you know, we didn't know too much at the time, but hey, we're here.
Wow. And that was actually going to be my next question. How old were you? Because I know people listening are going to ask that question. How old were you when you first did it? And you both sound ambitious and were ready. And some of the other questions I think people are going to obviously ask, did college play a major role in driving you to this? And if someone's listening that does not have the college experience or education around this, can they still do it?
So that's a really great question. I think for me, college gave me like the confidence and the skill set to have the audacity to sit at tables, you know, very early on and young. And so I learned a skill set in college, but to be completely honest, I think our backgrounds as athletes and D1 athletes and those types of, you know, attributes that you get from that need to really dive in and hustle and do the work, all of those pieces were really, really important. So there wasn't a class specifically that said, you know, you buy this house and you get this lender and you hire that contractor, right? We created that opportunity, created that own education in college ourselves because we didn't have that. But you know, I think the skill sets that you're able to build and create through experiences become really, really helpful when it's time to let the rubber meet the road and do the work.
So bottom line is a driven person, similar to pretty much what any entrepreneur would say, you have to be self-motivated and driven. And through athleticism, you were able to catapult that into this. And, you know, somebody who might not have had that college experience has another experience. If they're driven, they can do this, correct?
Yeah. It's really about knowing and understanding your goals and being really clear about what they are, setting that plan to figure out how you're going to make it happen, and then doing the work. And I think a lot of times we let the work or the goal overwhelm us so that we don't take, you know, even the smallest steps of action towards our goals each day. And that's what keeps us stagnant. And so as an athlete and all those things, I knew I had to do the work to get the results that I needed. And so for everyone, though, the formula is exactly the same. What is your goals and what are you looking to do and accomplish? How do you get there? What are those steps? And then it's time to roll up your sleeves and do the work.
So one of the things in my intro that I mentioned, a few of the things I should say that I've mentioned in the intro, talking about generational wealth and passing it down. And you mentioned Hensonville and the land that your family owned. And as we talk about the Civil Rights Act of 1968, that wasn't that long ago. I mean, you think that's really not that long ago. That's like a young uncle for me. You know, we talk about the National Housing Conference in 1973. I'm a 70s baby. That's not that long ago. I don't feel old. And this is when they were still having significant conversations about redlining. And Baltimore is one of the cities that is like a textbook redlining city. And for people who don't necessarily understand what redlining is, it's basically disenfranchising people of color from getting a fair opportunity at mortgages. And people were placed in specific communities that just didn't have the proper resources. And we are still feeling the effects of that. So as we get into a little bit more deeper into this conversation, Khalil, if you want to just walk me through what Charm City Buyers is about, what your basic concept is and what you all do.
Yeah, so we are Charm City Buyers is a vertically integrated real estate development and education company. We focus primarily in neighborhoods that are on the fringe of development, quote unquote, transitional areas or forgotten areas. And we bring life through the development activities that we do and also through other kind of extending ourselves beyond a typical constructor or developer. Our goal is to continue impacting Baltimore in a positive way, eradicate as many of these vacancies as possible, not only through us, but through our participants in our Next Gen Accelerator program, who are running around and buying up all of Baltimore at this point. And that's, in a nutshell, who Charm City Buyers is.
Yeah, our big goal right now is for between us and our students and our impact in Baltimore, do 2,400 doors by within the next 3 to 5 years. So what we've been able to do is create this opportunity where, you know, we're out here, we're doing the work every day. We're able to share that experience and knowledge and things, resources that we've learned along the way with folks who are, you know, really know, understand, you know, redlining, no one understand the challenges of Baltimore, no one understand that what you think of and you, you know, picture when you hear Baltimore, whether it's The Wire and all that kind of stuff, understanding that there is a model for what's happening in Baltimore. We've seen and understand what that looks like. And so we're able to do the work to create better and different results. So we're all in on really being able to change the narrative on what it looks like, not only for who and what Baltimore is, but what Baltimore continues to look like as it changes and develops over this cycle.
Right. And I'm going to go back to you, Khalil, and I want to find out what vertically integrated means so I can understand that more. And I want to also just ask about, are these more owner-occupied rental properties? Are they flips to be, renovated and sold? What's the main concept? How are they being marketed more so?
Sure. So when I say vertically integrated, the best way to think about it is almost like a sandwich shop, where one person may get the bread and put butter on it. The next person may put some meat or cheese on it. The next person puts on lettuce and tomatoes, and you kind of pass it through. Well, vertically integrated is when you do all of the steps within your company. So for us, we are developers in that we run financial models. We look for projects of our own. We have a in-house construction company, so we can do the physical work also. We have the educational component where we can continue growing and scaling well beyond what Kiara and I can do. And then we're launching a fund, and that'll help us bring in some capital so that we can continue doing it as efficiently as possible. So we're looking to control as much as possible the supply chain so that we can increase efficiencies and run a nice smooth engine.
Smart. So basically, to make this even plainer, you are the record company who is distributing the record, and you're getting the profits from all of that. So keep it all under one umbrella.
I think even beyond that, it's like, how do we, like, the biggest issues that people have are, you know, where do I find a good contractor? I can't get the lenders. We're still seeing the remnants of redlining today. Mm-hmm. And so as we're trying to create a better pathway for people to want to live and invest in Baltimore, we also wanted to solve a lot of the problems that they were coming across. How do we help streamline that issue and that process? So believe me, it's not always profits. A lot of times it's just really wanting to do the work and make sure people get great results.
One-stop shop almost, so that it's not a very complicated bureaucracy of here, there, and everywhere to try to get these steps accomplished.
Absolutely.
And Khalil, I apologize. I think you were going to go into the owner-occupied rental flip thing.
Yep, exactly right. So when we first started, we were primarily focused on building a portfolio of rentals. For about 5, maybe 4 years now, we've been focused primarily and intensely on for sale housing. There's a huge need for sale housing, for home ownership opportunities at the market rate, as well as the affordable levels. So we play in both spaces. And we're able to accomplish that. We provide the same quality of housing, almost the same materials. as you know, for both style of houses. But we feel passionate that home ownership is a gateway to wealth, especially now as we see prices of homes increasing so rapidly. At the end of the day, you know, there's not much more land being created, right? So the number of people who are being born and the population growth, prices of land and prices of houses are going to continually go up. Over the last 100 years, they've gone up. There have been dips and different kind of resets, but all in all, the price of houses have gone up. So we feel confident that if we can eliminate vacants and also provide home ownership where those vacants used to be, then it's a win-win for the city. It's a win-win for the new buyer, the community, for us. It's just a great opportunity.
And we need people that look like the city citizens and residents of Baltimore to be part of that homeowner process, because right now that number, at least from a 2020 ABLE report, it was a July 2020 ABLE report that showed that Baltimore's Black home ownership was down to around 42%. And the population of Black Baltimoreans is 63%. So well below, even though the national average is about 43%. And we know that the Black population across the country is much lower than 43%. So there's certainly a lot of work to do. And that 42% number was down significantly. And this was based on 2017 numbers. So there's a lot of opportunity. And when I spoke again earlier in the intro about why Baltimore is a great place to invest, if you look at some of our neighboring jurisdictions, as far as the suburbs and the cities, DC, Philadelphia, New York, they're priced out. So Baltimore's still a good place to snag a nice house, correct?
Absolutely.
Exactly right. Yeah, no question about it.
Yeah, so we're seeing tons of people moving in from other cities because you're getting three times the house for a quarter of the price. So why not?
That, and that's a big deal. And as more of that happens, you build up that equity and have that opportunity to pass it down, creating that magical word of generational wealth. And that is the key to longevity, keeping your name alive. So I don't want to bury the lead much longer because I know what people want to know. This is what people want to know. All right. Well, how much does it cost me? How much does it cost me to do it? I don't have a lot of money. I would love to be able to contribute. How much capital or how much cash do I actually need to get started and participate?
Yeah, if I had a dollar for everyone, every time someone asked me for a number specifically. So what's challenging is that the investment, the cost to invest in real estate, to buy real estate, depends on a lot of different factors. What I do like to say is that what you may lack in cash, you got to be able to make up and hustle. Right. And so there's a lot of different ways to be able to structure your investment in real estate to fit where you are financially. Right. So say you don't have a ton of cash and capital, but you want to buy a property and you want home ownership. Well, there are organizations like NACA, N-A-C-A, where you can have, you know, 0% down payment loans and really low interest rates and things like that. It's going to take you some hustle to go through the process, but it's there, right? You might have some capital, but you don't want to use any of it. You want to use the least amount as possible. Keep more of that money in your pocket. Well, in Baltimore City, we have all of these incentives that are out there to help offset your closing costs and those types of things. So you have to spend a little bit of hustle to make sure you're doing your homeownership counseling, you're doing the research on what programs and things are out there, filing the paperwork that you need to be successful. And so there's a lot of ways to get in, especially when you're willing to move into a property. Maybe you still want to do a renovation. Well, what does it look like to use, you know, a FHA 203K loan or a home style loan to be able to buy a property to move into and get some funding from that loan to do your rehab? So there's a lot of ways to get things done and manage the financial investment to make that happen, especially if you're willing to move into the property. A lot of these loans The incentives and the grants and things may have some other requirements, but a lot of these loans require you to live in a property for a year, right? A lot of us can do just about anything for a year. So what does it look like if you, you know, position yourself to really focus on your goals and figure out what it is that you need to do to make those things happen? So I've worked with people and even in our own deals have, you know, bought properties and done things 100% cash. And I've bought properties and worked with people who bought properties with zero money out of pocket. It really just depends on how the deal is structured and what you're willing to do, how much hustle you're willing to put in to structure the deal how you need it to go.
So there again, there are going to be a number of people who have various needs. They want to own a house for themselves. They want to accumulate some rental properties. They want to flip and sell. If you could just, again, just kind of like a wish list, because there are obvious barriers. Is there any support that you need that kind of slows the process down, or it takes longer than you thought? Is it a permitting issue? Is it some paperwork getting caught up? Should there be more tax breaks for the work that you're doing? Minority contracts? Have you run into those obstacles? Is that something that you see that maybe could be addressed, whether it's on a local level, state level, or even federal level?
Yeah, absolutely. We do a lot of work local and state officials. Close, you know, definitely really super involved in that stuff. But I know within actually the last couple of weeks, I was part of putting together a proposal talking about some of those bottleneck issues when you're doing renovations or trying to just do the work. So, you know, whether it's figuring out how we can automate the inspection process better, right? Know where my inspector is. When are they actually going to show up? Nowadays, you know, you kind of get a range of time. They're going to come between 9 and 12, and they may come at 9, they may come at 12, or they may get backed up and not show up at all. And so, like, some from a local level, there's definitely some technology opportunities, although we have seen, you know, DHCD and Baltimore City invest in, you know, their maps and invest in the permit technology that we're using today over the last several years, which is great. Chloe, I know you've been working on things from like a state federal level, if you want to jump in there.
Yeah, absolutely. So from that standpoint, I know we talked a little bit about permits. I think the permit process, you know, is relatively smooth, all things considered. But one thing that I think of immediately are variances. I look at cities like Chicago, New York, DC, where two-unit flats are relatively common. Well, in Baltimore City, they are not. And variances would help. And why not allow a homeowner to convert part of their house into some kind of cash flow opportunity? I think if we could figure out the variance process, that could be helpful, streamlining it. At the state level, there's a tax credit that expires this year. They created a stopgap, and hopefully they can bring that back, because it's a valuable one that would eliminate vacant properties and help to keep the historic charm in Charm City. You know, there's always going to be opportunities. By and large, I think we're at a good place, but a little less siloed from different agencies throughout the development process could always help and improve communication. But yeah, that's a couple of things.
Yeah, I will say there's a bill, and Claude, jump in because I can't remember the name of it, but a bill that they're working on right now to really essentially fill the gap when it comes to investing in some of these neighborhoods where the cost of construction is so astronomically high, property values aren't able to support doing the renovation. So we're running into those types of issues in, you know, many neighborhoods across Baltimore City. And so there's a bill right now that we're excited about.
Yeah, so it was originally introduced last session and it got passed. It wasn't funded, but it got passed. And basically it's the appraisal gap bill. And it provides funding to bridge the gap between the value of the house and the cost it takes to fix it. And you know, if that were funded and gets moving, that could create a momentum of opportunities where vacant properties that are valued at, say, for example, $100,000 bucks, but need $150,000 or $200,000, they would be able to provide those funds from the state in order to make sure that the gap is filled. Since our last session, when it originally got passed, the name has shifted a bit. So now it's called the HOW program, Home Ownership Works. And there's going to be some changes in the fine print and everything there. But if it gets funded this year, fingers crossed, then I think that would be very helpful.
And, you know, I think the council president in Baltimore, Nick Mosby, proposed the Dollar Home program, and it was good intent. But what you just said might be part of the gap issue in Baltimore as to why that was killed by the council ultimately. Not enough funding and investment there for people who want to buy those houses to actually get them repaired. And you would end up being stuck with this house and not enough money to actually repair it, which kind of creates the problem that we're in now, which kind of rolls me right into the next question. You know, you bring somebody in from out of state and they might not have ever been to Baltimore, and they see certain parts of the city and they think something happened, like a natural disaster. And because they're blocks without residents, they're blocks where trees are growing out of homes. And there are no roofs left on houses. There, it's unbelievable. And sadly, recently, we lost three firefighters, and one continues to fight for his life, falling through a vacant home that was on fire. And it's a normal thing during the winter months, especially, to have vagrants or just to have a vacant home catch on fire. Do you think we're able to catch up? The estimates are 15,000 plus, and that's a low end estimate of vacant homes. We have Project Core. We have people like you and some others out there. Do you really think we can catch up, or do we need expanded programming to really start expediting the demolition of some of the homes in the city?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated but very integrated, like, response answer, right? We need everyone. We need all of the things together. We need, you know, nonprofit, for-profit, affordable housing, the city, the state, the federal, we need all of those pieces to come together in a really great way. And that's something I'm really excited about right now in Baltimore, is that there is so much collaboration, and there's so much conversation between, you know, folks like us and, you know, folks on the city council and the mayor and, you know, the State Department of Housing and our local, which is really exciting, because when collectively we have a seat at the table, we're able to troubleshoot things. But to specifically answer your question, I think the conversation we're having right now about Baltimore is probably the conversation that folks had about Harlem in the 80s. And look where that neighborhood is now, where Brooklyn is now. And so can we turn it around? Absolutely. I think it really just becomes a matter of addressing the history of Baltimore, you know, that strong history of redlining, and how we are continuing to see that today. It comes with, you know, incentivizing businesses and folks to come into Baltimore and employ our residents, so that they have, you know, they're able to have this living wage where they can afford to live where they are. And it's these types of bills like the one Khalil brought up, the HOW program or others, to be able to make sure, you know, we can turn that corner. And there's just so many ideas out there, from how we do our property taxes to otherwise, to really incentivize people to continue to move into Baltimore, build that tax basis up. We need to work on that reputation, work on, you know, changing that narrative, but also leverage, you know, those tax incentives and all of the resources that we can, to make sure that we're doing the work now to prepare for what's coming. I'm very optimistic about Baltimore, obviously, right? We invest a lot in the city. But beyond just you know, beyond just kind of speculation, right? It's, we've done this before in cities just like Baltimore. And so hindsight is supposed to be 2020. If we know what that looks like and feels like, now's the time to make sure that we're doing something different to get better results. And that's really what we've been intensely focused on for the last decade.
Yeah, I think the argument that capital is going to fix it all is partially true. Absolutely. The more capital that can come into programs and things and just come into the city in general is going to help. But obviously those dollars can't all come from public dollars, right? If the numbers don't work, then the numbers don't work. And there's a reason for that. And these gap bills and these credits and these grants, yes, helpful in the short term, but it's artificially creating a market that, you know, arguably it may not last the long run. One book that I'm reading right now is a book called Boomtowns by Stephen Walters. Mm-hmm. And he's an economist out of Loyola.
Maryland Public Policy Group. Yep.
Yeah, exactly right. I'm glad you know. Mm-hmm. And he's done a lot of extensive research. And his argument is that if you lower the property taxes, which Baltimore City property taxes are the highest in the region.
Yes, by double.
By double, exactly right. Mm-hmm. Exactly right. Then it will, it will cause private dollars to then come in. And he's evidenced this in cities like Boston and San Francisco and mm-hmm. and Milwaukee and other cities. So I think, it's a scary thought. If our budget is already really tight and we lower the property taxes, how long can the city be fiscally responsible without seeing this kind of upswing? But it's something that, like Kiara said, if we want to do different, we have to think different, and that will drive additional private dollars into the city in the form of, capital for development, capital for jobs, all kind of different things. And I think that could be helpful.
That is such an irony, two ironies here, because my next question was actually going to be about the Maryland Public Policy Group, Stephen Walters in particular, and you just brought it up, and you also said think different, which I went crazy a couple of years ago. I don't know if y'all know this or not. I decided to run for public office, and nice. My slogan was think different, but I truly believe that, and what Stephen Walters and his crew, several much smarter people than me, want to bet on, and betting on Baltimore is really a bullish reduction in property tax to get an influx of people buying homes here and in essence making up that that loss in property taxes by bringing in more residents and bringing in more businesses that make up that growth. And then gradually you will start to increase taxes at some point or another, not to the level where they are today. And it kind of leads me into another question of what do you think we can do more to drive home ownership and increase home ownership and residency here in Baltimore? The property tax cut, I think, is one that we're mentioning here. I know Live Baltimore does a lot of different things to really promote the city and housing. Do you guys have any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, Chloe. We're actually sponsored at Live Baltimore, very supportive of what they do. I'm very big on sharing the culture and the beauty of Baltimore and its people. I think a lot of times the challenge people have with Baltimore is that what they think of when they hear Baltimore is directly tied to The Wire or things that they see on the news every day. And understanding that that is also a reality of the city, there's a lot happening in Baltimore. There's a lot of growth. We are a foodie city. We have amazing restaurants and place to go and things to see. And I think we need to share that side of Baltimore and understand that, knowing that Baltimore is a tale of two cities means that in that same vein, there's that tale of two cities around, who Baltimore and what Baltimore is and all about. So we've been doing a lot with trying to share, what we love about this city and make sure that folks know and understand how much growth and opportunity potential there is, of course, but also just how awesome, the city of Baltimore is and always has been and hopefully always will be.
Yeah, I tell my buddy, Mr. Al Hutchinson from Visit Baltimore, that he has one of the toughest jobs. He used to joke with me when I was the spokesperson for the city police department that I had the toughest job. I said, no, you have the toughest job because you have to sell the city. And it is so much. And you guys mentioned it. But that's the hard part. You have to convey that something's going to happen in this area that we're asking you to invest in. And, you know, has that contributed a bit to the blight where we have these absentee landlords who own all of this property and seem to be holding it as a bet because they're betting that the area is going to finally turn around and they can either sell it to a developer or they can redevelop it themselves? Mm-hmm. Do you think that's part of the problem or no?
Absolutely. That's a big thing. And we try to really toe the line and we actually have entire YouTube videos like, do not come here, buy a vacant property for $5,000 and not do the work. Right. We're very much, you know, you have to come in and do the work. Which is also why we try to streamline and make sure those resources are there for people who are looking to come in and invest in the city so they can actually get it done. That's a huge risk to the city if we continue that history of people coming in and speculating and sitting on properties. And that's something that I'm hoping, you know, the city can help push forward is holding people accountable. Right. You know, anyone that owns property in the city or is an investor in the city knows what that envelope looks like when you're getting, you know, a notice from an inspector or something about environmental issues or needing to make sure you're doing the work. And so we need to really hold people accountable to that as more information comes out about the market, the real estate market in Baltimore over the last really 2 years on how hot it's been and how, you know, property values have been continuing to increase and, you know, permits are being pulled everywhere. And there's a lot of, you know, people really moving into the city over the last 2 years. And so with that is going to drive speculation. Having auctions be online versus in person has given a lot of people from out of state or even out of the country opportunities to bid up properties to levels that just don't make any sense to anyone who knows or understands Baltimore. And so it is a huge risk. And so I think as before you're asking about like, what are some things that we need to be doing or thinking about? We have to mitigate that risk by holding people accountable to doing the work, right? When you buy a property from one house at a time, the auctioneer through that Baltimore City works with to handle properties that have gone through receivership, you know, the requirement is that you complete the renovation within 12 months, whether that's through OHAD or vacants to value. And so we really need to hold people's feet to the fire to make sure that we're, you know, not just offloading vacant properties, but getting them into the hands of people who can actually get it done.
And so I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and you all feel free to tell me, say, hey, you have to sign up for the course to get these questions answered. So feel free to tell me, because they might be a little bit more in the weeds, but I'm just genuine curiosity because this is something that's out there. What are your thoughts for people who might want to come in and invest in the foreclosure market? And if so, are there strategies that are recommended if you're investing in a foreclosure market?
I think the strategy you're going to take in the foreclosure market is probably going to be pretty similar to a lot of others. So if you're working with foreclosures, a lot of times you're waiting for the property to be listed by the bank or realtors. And so the important piece is, again, like kind of, you know, is you can leverage this process for a lot of different sources for your deals. But you have to have a plan, a financial plan, right? So you have to know and understand where you're going to get the funding from, not only to purchase that foreclosed or off-market deal or, you know, auction property, not just how you're going to purchase, but how you're going to complete that renovation, mm-hmm. right? Because again, we want to make sure we're getting people who are getting it from beginning to end. So what's your financial plan? For folks, usually that's the biggest hurdle. So a lot of times I say you want to build your well before you're thirsty. So start having conversations with lenders when it comes to whether that be bank lenders, mortgage brokers, hard money lenders, having those conversations before you actually find the deal so that you have a source of funding when you're ready to get in. From there, it's going through and saying, okay, I'm looking at this property, this foreclosure home. I want to know and understand what the cost of renovation is going to be. So I might walk through that property with, you know, 2-3 different contractors to get estimates and bids. So I have an understanding of what that renovation cost is going to be. And then I'm going to also look in this area, in this neighborhood, In Baltimore, sometimes it's within this 2-3 block radius, right? So in that like neighborhood, what is the valuation on this property going to be after I complete this renovation? So when you know how much your renovation cost is going to be, you know how much the property is going to be worth once it's completed, you're clear on what your plan is for the property. Are you going to move in? Are you going to rent it out? Are you going to flip it? You can pretty much back into, okay, what is the sweet spot cost? What's the price that I'm willing to pay for this property, right? With foreclosures, a lot of times there's a negotiation. So they may say, I want $100,000 for this price, for this house. You being diligent in knowing and understanding your numbers and how to analyze deals, you're going to offer what makes sense for you. So if they ask for 100 and your numbers say 20, then you might offer 18, right? And so to kind of start that conversation and go through the process, but you know, really to be successful in real estate, you have to know and understand your numbers, and you have to have that resource and team lined up so that you're able to run through the process. So once you have the deal, once you purchase the property and close on it, now it's kind of like a race against the clock to be able to get your renovation done and put yourself in a position to make the property functional, right? Have it the renovation completed so you can rent it, or have the renovation completed so you can move in, or have the renovation completed in order to flip. So you want to have your numbers, and you want to have your team, and understand your financial resources as well.
Is that something you guys do often? Are you into the foreclosures, or you are more into the, I want to buy it flat out and own it and do what I have to do in my time frame, and I know what I'm dealing with, and that's it.
We're more into the private market. Now we do work within city-owned properties, larger development projects, and with the affordable housing, we kind of dabble in both. But when we first got started, it was the private market. As we kind of grew and scaled and transitioned initially to for sale housing, it was the private market. And recently, within the last kind of 2 to 3 years, we've been working more on city-owned properties.
Yeah, but the process is virtually the same. When the process switches up is more so when you're working with short sales. Those are a longer tail process where basically the person selling the property, they're working with the bank. The bank's decided to take less than what they're owed in order to get some money, right? So the mortgage is behind. They negotiate with the bank to be able to say, okay, we owe you $100,000, but if we sell this property right now, you might get whatever, 80. And so the short sale process is a longer tail where you're working usually with consultants, you're negotiating a bit. It might take you several months to get to a point where you're actually able to close. That process is a little different, but again, you still need to have all those pieces that I mentioned before as your process and your resources.
So we're in this weird financial space right now, and it looks like interest rates are going to start to rise a little bit potentially, and it looks like the housing market is not really super hot as far as a lot of houses being available for people to go get. What are your thoughts on that? Is this like the perfect time for people to go out and do these types of investments? Have you changed your approach or strategy in your business with where we are in the economy right now and where interest rates are and might be going?
With inventory low, supply and demand, the demand is going to increase and the prices of houses continues to go up, which is, couple that with interest rates slowly kind of showing signs of creeping upwards. That's going to get a lot of people who are kind of dilly-dallying, looking at it, but passively looking off the fence and ready to buy houses. I don't want to pay more interest. I'm going to buy a house now.
Right.
So yes, the answer to the question is now's the time.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm always big on like, there's different approaches. The real estate is a cycle, right? It's cyclical. We always have these ebbs and flows. And usually this time of year, the market tends to slow down anyway, in and around kind of that holiday season and beginning of the year. Usually when tax season starts to hit, it picks up again into the spring going into the summer. So we're in kind of a normal annual cycle, but the overall cycle of real estate continues to move. And there's always opportunities at every part of that cycle. Your approach just might shift a little bit. So for us right now, like us personally, we're focused on some larger development projects. So we're going to be doing 50 new construction homes right in the footprint of Johns Hopkins. So we've been doing larger development deals, but for our mentees and our students, they've still been buying properties to move into Baltimore and be new residents, to buy rental properties. They're still flipping properties. There's still a lot of opportunity here. But to close point, you do want to watch and understand what's happening with those interest rates. Pay attention to make sure that whether it's tax incentives like CHAP, the Historic Tax Credit Program, or different grants and things that are out there, just, you know, keeping an eye to make sure that things stay funded, right? I think that becomes a really big risk in Baltimore specifically, when we have all these programs that are kind of, you know, propping up the market a little bit. There's that risk if the carpet gets pulled under, what happens to the real estate market here? And so I'm always, you know, watching to see what's happening there, in addition to those interest rates and everything else that's happening across the from a Fed level.
So you mentioned just now, I heard the Hopkins footprint. Mm-hmm. Do you all target specific areas, or do you have an area where you see specific opportunity? I can't imagine. I mean, or I don't want to say that. I don't want to make a presumption. But are you looking at the city long-term plans and saying, okay, let's go here and invest? Or how do you see your opportunities when you do decide this is an area that we think we want to go in and invest and buy up a block?
One step further, we're part of the conversation where the city's having plans. Okay. And they're making those choices. With us being in the industry for 10 years, we've made a lot of different connections with people, with nonprofits, with CDCs, with for-profit developers and everybody else. So as we kind of continue getting our face at the table, it's exciting. We can hear about what's going on in different areas like East Baltimore and different areas in West and be part of the conversation, but also able to help kind of predict where Baltimore City's going.
So I want to quickly reset with you, Charm City Buyers, because you have the seat at the table, and a prospective investor who might only want one property, two properties, et cetera, through some of your coaching and mentorship and classes, you have the seat at the table, and you're basically the conduit that is going to be able to connect them to those resources that you have. You have that knowledge. They don't necessarily need to have the seat at the table because you already have it and are able to pass that on to a prospective student that wants to get involved, correct?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, I think for us, for decades, right, there's always been someone, an uncle, a cousin, you know, a dad who had a seat at the table and was able to kind of usher everyone else along. And so it's really great for us to be able to leverage that same opportunity and just usher folks along for what's coming. That's part of what we do. But beyond that, right, if you don't have a seat at the table and you're not on, you know, a mayoral committee or, you know, different committees that are all over the place in the city, like we're being tapped into, you know, the next best thing is to read the newspaper, right? You hear about what's not only happening today, but what's going to be planned and what's coming in the future, and really start to look at, well, I just heard that neighborhood, you know, in an article that I read 3 days ago. Now there's this other development that's coming up over here too, like starting to look at those types of recurring events. And then you also, you know, when possible, you should be showing up at those community association meetings. They're also going to be the ones that know and understand what's coming and what's happening, building those relationships, of course, but learning and understanding what's coming and happening in those neighborhoods. With COVID was a really great opportunity because everything was virtual. Right, so if you weren't right there, you could just listen in and hear what was happening and what was being presented to the community associations. And so, you know, of course, you know, Chloe and I are at that level. We're able to not only have a seat at the table, but influence those plans across the city, but everyone can learn and be, you know, educated on, you know, what's happening and what's coming, and be able to kind of deduce, all right, well, if all these things are happening in, you know, this area of West Baltimore, then I know that there's investment coming. And so if I can follow the money, right, I'm going to be able to ride the wave that's being created from those developments. And that's part of it as well.
So let's again, reset again, go back to the very beginning. One of the first things you both said to me, and this is to everyone listening, is hustle. So you got to hustle and get to those. You might not need to go in and sit with the politicians or the big developers or whatever, but going into the community meetings and understanding what's going on in these specific communities can help you target your investment if that's what you want to do. So yes, I appreciate those, Jules. A couple more questions and we'll wrap this up because we could talk all day about this because this is really exciting stuff and necessary. And I think so many people want to do it, but they just don't have the know-how. And one of the things, when it comes to financial institutions, where do you all suggest? And I know you what was the word? Let me see if I can remember it. The vertically integrated process as far as lending and borrowing, the relationship. Do you suggest people go to the credit unions, the community banks, the large banks, the hard money lenders? Or do you have a specific bank that you work with that is, you know, Baltimore friendly, so to speak, that understands what you all are doing and what you're bringing people in to do?
Yeah, we have a ton of relationships with different banks. It's always nice when it's really nice when they come reach out to you. That's always a great place to be as well. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think where people start, a lot of times it's always great to start with where you house your money. Right. Where you house your money, where your direct deposits are hitting are always a great place to start that conversation for, you know, what the banking institution offers as far as home ownership. There are some really great credit unions in Baltimore and community banks in Baltimore that are really interested in supporting what's happening in the city and wanting to lend to different institutions. What we do a lot of times specifically with our students is try to connect the dots between folks that we have relationships with. So whether that's, you know, Baltimore Community Lending or mortgage brokers that we have relationships with that provide funding for not only investors, but also home ownership, or even just under, you know, having the resources to share the process. If you wanted to go through a program like NACA, you know, understanding who to, you know, who other people worked with and how you set yourself up for success with that. But I think sometimes we get caught up in the minutia, right? You know, which do I talk to, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, or CQ, right? And then we get stuck. You know, I don't know which one to talk to. And so I think it really actually goes back to everyday action, right? If you don't know who you want to talk to, then talk to them all. And you don't need to have them all pull your credit. I'm saying don't have them all pull your credit, but ask them, can you send me, you know, your loan product documents. All the banks will have usually a 1 or 2 page document that outlines their interest rates, the points that they may charge, you know, just really laying out how long they need in order to close, right? What's their underwriting criteria? Start stacking up those documents and starting to learn and understand what some of the advantages or disadvantages are to working with different banks, whether they're community or large or small or what have you, so that you are, again, kind of starting to build that well before you're thirsty, starting to build those resources and opportunities before it's time to pull the trigger. So now you've already built that relationship. One, you have information. Two, and then when it's time, when you have the right deal, you're able to reach out. And now it's like, okay, now it's time for you all to compete for my business. So what I think a lot of people forget is that you can actually negotiate or have conversations at least to a certain level with your bank or mortgage broker to say, you know, I got this, this kind of quote or, you know, preliminary approval from this bank who said that they're going to charge me 3.25%. Well, you said 3.65, right? What's the difference between those things? Can we get it down, right? Are you willing to compete for my business? And I think a lot of people skip that step and kind of take the easy, you know, I got pre-approved and so this is who I'm working with, when the truth of the matter is, you know, you can really shop around for the right lender that's going to work best for you. So first step, I would say work with whoever you bank with, but from there, do some research on who's around you. And, you know, start looking into to what they are, what they offer. And I, for Baltimore properties, I would specifically ask, you know, about their experience in Baltimore, because we do have those nuances like ground rent or, you know, these just weird things that that Baltimore has, property values. Some banks won't lend on properties that the purchase price is less than $100,000. Well, if you know that and you know you're buying a property that's $40,000, then that's not going to be a fit for you. And so spending that time to do the research and, again, rolling up your sleeves and doing the work. We'll never be the get rich quick. You know, it's super easy. You just, you know, throw a dart on a map, buy that house and you're going to be rich. That's not that's not our thing. It's work. And so, you know, when you have a goal and you're willing, you want to go after, you know, what you want, you got to kind of roll up your sleeves and be ready to do the work to make it happen.
All right. Well, two final questions for you guys. And this one, it kind of is something that is really innate to Baltimore. And that's trades. You know, we have a number of really great trade high schools in Baltimore. And as Khalil knows, this is a city of high schools. And I know you've come to learn as well that this is a city of high schools. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are with so many vacant properties and the need really for more people to be trained in the area of HVAC and plumbing, electrical, you know, construction, et cetera, to have more young people learning about that, that they can hit the ground running at upon graduation to really be hands-on and rebuilding. Are you seeing a big need for that, where it could be young Baltimoreans and particularly young Black Baltimoreans taking on a lot of those jobs? Are you seeing a need for that out there?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a historical need that's been going around for a while. And it's not just in Baltimore. Almost every major city, there's a shortage of contractors and trades folks. One of the reasons, and a little bit of history just for a second, you know, finance was super popular in a while, in the 80s and the 90s, and everybody wanted a Wall Street job and all those types of things. Well, people forgot about the blue collar workers that are really needed to keep driving the economies. Except people like you and I and other folks in the city who are really, you know, taking the time to figure out what those trades are that are needed, and then developing programming around it to ensure that folks who a college may not be the path, it's not the path for everybody, and that's fine, but there are other alternative paths. Councilman Robert Stokes has a program, and I'm gonna blank on the details of it, including the name, but he's working on a program for that exact reason. And part of it is to provide education for future construction tradespeople. There are several other programs throughout the city. I can think of ABC over in East Baltimore and more. But yes, to answer your question, there's an absolute need.
Yeah. And, you know, the reality is, even as we talk about the trades, I had a conversation a few years ago now with a gentleman, Adam, who was great. And he was thinking outside the box, like, can we think of creating a partnership with a Home Depot, a Lowe's, a 84 Lumber, a local lumber yard, whatever, and build houses as almost modules where people can walk in and say, I want a house that looks like this. And the young people can basically build it. And they learn this, starting even in middle school, learn some of the art of it, and then get into hands-on come high school. But you look at some of the other jobs that go along with it, it doesn't have to be as hands-on. The need is there for the bankers who finance it. The need is there for the real estate agent. The need is there for the tax attorneys or the law, the land attorneys or what have you. So I think it's so many opportunities still in Baltimore. And with that, I want to just ask you, what are your dreams and goals? I know in 3 to 5 years, you have a goal of about 2,400 more doors. What about 10 years down the line? Where do you guys see yourselves?
That's a great question. I see myself still in a space where we're making positive community impact. And we are engaged at a deeper level, a more meaningful level, and a broader level. I think as we continue to grow and grow our companies, we'll be forced to the helm even more, where we transition from folks who are actively participating to our companies are now actively participating and doing more than we could have ever dreamed. And now we're thought leaders. And we are really setting the tone for 20 years, 30 years, 50 years from now, where you can see things like container homes becoming more popular and working directly with federal agencies to ensure that laws and things get passed so that lower priced homes can become more available. But a position as a thought leader, which, you know, some would argue that we already are, would be, I think that's where we go.
Yeah. I was about to say, I hate to break it to you, but you're already there. So we had to send you back to the drawing board because you guys are already there. You've made an amazing impact on Baltimore. Been following you both for a long time now and watching your positive impact. We need it. We need the boost of positivity through all of the despair that we go through on a regular basis, and highlighting all the good stuff. So where can people find you? Because there are going to be people that want to sign up. Where can people find you on social and on the web?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are all over socials. So you can find us at Charm City Buyers on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. So Charm City Buyers, excuse me, on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We do have a really great YouTube channel. And so we're Charm City Buyers on YouTube. There are so many videos up there to talk about what we do. You can follow us for the day. You can see us walking through properties, a little bit of everything on that YouTube channel. And we actually have a weekly live free class that we have where we're sharing and educating people on Baltimore, on the things that they need to know and understand in order to be successful here. And, you know, really kind of grounding them in that foundation of knowledge about the city so that they know how to move once they decide to invest and start buying property here. So we are all over at Charm City Buyers on Instagram and everywhere else. And then charmcitybuyers.com. We look forward to meeting new people and connecting and hopefully welcome you guys into our Next Gen Accelerator program, where we're really focused on making sure that people are spending more time being successful in Baltimore real estate and less time banging their head against the wall trying to figure out how to navigate this world. So
free seminar. So the hustle starts for free on your butt virtually. I mean, you can't ask for anything better, but like was said earlier and multiple times, you have to hustle if you want to do it. Nothing in life is free, or at least the best things in life aren't as easily attainable for free. You got to work to get them. So I appreciate it. This has been a very insightful conversation and certainly motivational as well. So thank you to both of you, and thank you all for listening. Remember, the 2B More podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. Let's continue to aim to be more. Until next time, take care.